What's behind the outbreak of mass shootings and what can stop it? Would banning more types of guns or more features of guns or giving officials more power to seize guns solve the problem? Or is a more radical solution necessary, as argued by those who say the U.S. Constitution itself is the obstacle to safety? And is there wisdom in President Biden's plan to cancel college student debt, or would that degrade student borrowers while further boosting inflation, which now looms as America's greatest anxiety? We'll talk about all this and more in today's episode of Independent Outlook. Hello, everyone. I'm Graham Walker, coming to you today from the Independent Institute in Oakland, California. We're right across the bay from San Francisco. As I shared on our last broadcast, we recently lost our colleague David Thoreau, the founder of the Independent Institute and of this broadcast. He passed away suddenly and unexpectedly. David was a serial entrepreneur, a champion of liberty and law, writer and publisher of over 140 books, and of the influential quarterly, The Independent Review. We all miss him greatly. So for that reason, let's get started. And I want to welcome, as usual, one of David's longtime colleagues, Williamson Evers. Bill Evers is the head of Independent Institute's Center on Educational Excellence. Hello, Bill.
Hello.
Glad to have you, as always. And it's also a great pleasure to welcome Dr. Philip Magnus. Phil Magnus is a research fellow with the Independent Institute, also research director at the American Institute for Economic Research in Massachusetts. Dr. Magnus, you are the author of a number of books, right, including one called Colonization After Emancipation, Lincoln and the Movement for Black Resettlement, which is a book that is on my to-read list.
Excellent.
Welcome. We're so glad to have you, Phil.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
I think also our participants, our viewers today should know that you published very widely in a variety of places, including our own Independent Review, the Journal of History of Economic Thought, as well as in the Wall Street Journal, Newsweek, New York Times, et cetera. You get around, don't you, Phil?
A fair bit. Causing trouble, mostly.
We appreciate you because you are a historian who's also an economist. I guess you're an economic historian.
Yeah.
Yeah, there you go. Okay, so that's what we need today among many days. Before we get started, I also want to mention that we are joined by many friends around the country and sometimes overseas, too, on our YouTube page, our Facebook page, our Vimeo page, our Twitter page, and we have lots of friends who visit us from thinkspot.com. So we welcome all of them today. So, gentlemen, here we are in the aftermath of yet another mass shooting, this time in Uvalde, Texas, which I guess is halfway between San Antonio and Del Rio, to the west of San Antonio. Tragic situation. What are we to make of this, and what are we to make of the reactions to it? Maybe I'll start with Phil Magnus on this. A lot's being said pretty quickly, and I heard a lot of anger. I'm not sure what to make of it. Have any thoughts?
Yeah, well, I think the most disturbing thing that's happened so far is the extreme politicization of it, particularly from the left. There are people that have been pushing for very aggressive gun control measures that are more symbolic than actually effective at dealing with problems such as these. You know, they jumped on the Uvalde shooting almost instantly. We had Beto O'Rourke burst into the press conference with Governor Abbott.
That was quite a scene.
Yeah. just
like, he's rather self-dramatized.
Exactly. It's just a pure politicization of it. It's almost like the left has seen this as an opportunity to advance an issue that they really haven't gotten anywhere on in the past decade or more, basically since the early 2000s. I think it's just kind of shameless the way that they're exploiting it.
I think it's interesting. I think it's interesting because even Fox News, which is generally pretty skeptical of gun control measures, is kind of leaning, and you listen to Senator McConnell, and he's kind of leaning toward the famous phrase, do something. I found the most interesting part of this, the police, and how the police of the school district and the police of the town just failed. I mean, here, there's an established doctrine of what to do in the case of an active killer like this, and you're supposed to rush the guy and, you know, neutralize him. And instead, they sat around for an hour and the town has
sat
its
around.
Own.
I'm sure they were worried during that hour.
Yes, and they did get some people out of the building. I don't want to, but the point is not to do that. The point is to neutralize the man right away. And the town has its own SWAT team.
Yeah.
Things really only happen when the Border Patrol's SWAT team people came. And, you know, all sorts of other things, the flag law situation. So
the Border Patrol guys decided to rush in.
Yes.
In spite of being told otherwise.
Right. And the police also prevented parents, even, you know, parents who could protect themselves or didn't care whether they protect themselves from getting the children out. So there's the red flag idea that lots of people have that somehow we're going to diagnose out of all the millions of people with some kind of psychological problems. We're going to successfully pick out who the likely killers are. And of course, this man had no mental health record and no criminal record. And so nothing flagged him. And of course, he bought the guns completely legally. And so all these supposed remedies are just not right. And, you know, they were also talking about lowering the age at which you can buy weapons. Well, what about a young woman who needs to protect herself? You know, young women who are under 21 are sometimes living by themselves, or they're living with their family and still endangered by somebody. I don't see why they are denied the right of self-defense. A last thing about the police is you can't sue them.
Right.
If you were being protected by Wells Fargo Protection or Pinkerton's or Brinks or something like that, and they had a contract to protect you and they didn't do it, and it said rush the shooter in accordance, you know, whatever, and they didn't do it, you could sue. I mean, it wouldn't be the same as not having the children killed, but at least you'd have something. And I admit that there is some lawyering up going on among the police now, so maybe something will happen. But essentially, they have extremely strong immunity against failure to act.
That's because a police department is a branch of the state government.
Exactly.
And the state government is immune from tort suits. Is that how it works?
Yeah, basically.
So if we didn't give governmental agencies such immunity, there would be more accountability for these kind of misjudgments. Is that right, Phil?
Yeah. Well, you know, we can even go back to this question of the red flag laws that are on the books or that are being proposed. You know, we've talked about this, the current Uvalde shooter, there were no signs, but let's look at some of the more recent mass killings that we've had. The Parkland shooting in Florida, the killer there was someone who had in fact been flagged for mental health issues. There's word coming out that the Buffalo shooter from a couple weeks ago had been flagged for potential mental health issues, and the system itself basically failed. None of these remedies that were supposed to stop it actually stopped it. And on top of that, because it's the FBI, because it's government entities that are supposed to be enforcing these things, when they drop the ball, when they fail to block someone from getting a gun, you know, there's no remedy. You can't sue the FBI and say, hey, wait a minute, you failed to do your job here. You failed to do due diligence in screening this person.
There's also a deeper liberty problem with these red flag laws because they're claiming to predict who is going to, it's, you know, Minority Report, the movie. They're claiming in advance that they're going to predict who is going to be a criminal, who's going to act criminally. And they can't do that. We just don't have that kind of knowledge. And in my view, we can't have that kind of knowledge. We just, because of free will, because of the decisions that are going to be made by people, we can't say, oh, this person is going to be a mass murderer, and this person who is also kind of thinks he's Napoleon or whatever it is that is the problem is going to, you know, march on Moscow, whatever Napoleon's going to do. So,
Bill, let me just come back to that point one more time. Ordinary people, you know, thinking about this, listening to us talk, might still say, well, I still don't get it. And I'm not sure, I mean, don't quite get it. What would be so bad about having laws which allowed the government to take guns away from people who are dangerous. And your answer to that is not that that's a bad idea, but that the mechanism necessary to achieve that would have all sorts of unintended. If I got that right?
No, I don't think you've got quite what I.
Okay,
what,
say the whole
what
thing.
What they're saying and what I'm saying. So, okay. Yes, there are people that think, oh, it's obvious that, you know, we could obviously read the minds and wills and future actions of people. I don't believe that's true. And I also, it's just, you can punish people who do bad things after they're doing it. You can stop them when they're in the process of doing it. You can stop them when there's an obvious threat, a so-called clear and present danger. But to go earlier than that is a deprivation of liberty. And it's not the kind of political culture we have. We have a, you know, what are we? Are we the heirs of Locke? Are we the heirs of the spirit of the Declaration of Independence? Or are we the heirs of Ivan the Terrible in Russia? Or,
okay,
you know, Shang, the sort of founder of legalism in China, which is a horrible combination of Machiavellianism and legal positivism. I know I'm getting technical and in the weeds, but it's it's might is right and all might belongs to the state in that Chinese.
Now, theory. Phil, you had a comment about red flag a moment ago. Did I miss that comment?
Yeah, well, I think it's it raises an issue here. You know, when we're considering these proposals and they come out of the media, they come out of pundits and political actors, they are proposing measures that, at least in their minds, would work in an ideal world, that if government functioned perfectly, the red flag measures would catch every mass killer, the police would be there on site on time and be able to intervene or stop the killer before too much carnage is done. This is all, it's kind of like a fantasy land of imagining policy for a world that doesn't exist. And, you know, one of the things that I urge people to do when they're considering public measures through the government is always ask the question, not the government that you wish we had, but the government that we actually have, which is a mixture of corrupt, incompetent, lazy, prone to error, prone to basic human constraints that we all live under, right. Although oftentimes at a level that's multiplicative in the sense that government tends to be more corrupt and more dysfunctional than other areas of society because it doesn't face any of the incentive pressures to self-correct for that. So,
and also sometimes they're idealistic, but that's not always to the good either. No. In other words, you can have Julius Sanyeri, the famous leader of Tanzania, who was, you know, not corrupt and everything, and was a pretty honest ruler. The problem was he was a tyrant. He forced the peasants of the country into collective farms that were economic disasters. He was clean as a government goes, but, you know, so there are people in government who are idealistic and good people, but as Phil is saying, they don't face good incentives, and sometimes what they believe is a solution is actually something that's much, much worse than this. So you have to look at human nature, and you have to look exactly as Phil says, at the government we have.
Yeah, and you know, a moment ago you were mentioning about, you know, what if we can prevent bad people from doing bad things? If you really think about that, especially in our era when artificial intelligence is very operative, what if a bunch of algorithms got to work on the entire U.S. population and sorted out those people who seemed, because
that's
of their...
That's what this movie Minority Report
is. Yeah, characteristics. Dystopian. It would be incredibly awful. I mean, the downside would be so much worse than the upside that it's scary to think about. Speaking of which...
I think so, but, you know, the people that want to do it think, oh, well, we'll do it right.
Right.
Yeah. I mean... You can't help but thinking that there's a whole other dimension of this problem, which is, what is it about American culture in our era, which seems to be tossing up, generating from time to time, more frequently, individuals who are, you know, mentally unhinged, morally unstable, detached from community. These are underlying kind of preconditions that culturally dispose people toward all sorts of unpredictable actions they're not going to be addressed by legislation of any kind, but, right. but our society desperately needs
I think,
a morally sane culture again.
I think, you know, I'm a moderate conservative on cultural issues. And I think that the fact that the family is having a lot of trouble in our society, that, I mean, long ago, Milton Friedman said, if you look at the philanthropic societies that were founded in 1900, you'll see they're scattered around the country. Some are in Chicago, some are in Denver, some are in... You look now, then you look in recent years, they're all centered in Washington, and they're all lobbying associations, really. So civil society has become corrupted by the growth of big government. It's not as healthy as it should be. And as Jeffrey Tucker wrote a very interesting article, he's the head of Brownstone Institute, and we've all had interaction with him over the years. And he said, look, there's another interesting thing. Adam Smith talks in his theory of moral sentiments about empathy, about putting yourself in the other person's situation. We learn about morals in action through seeing them exemplified in society and in human interaction, and that reinforces our own moral life. And if you suddenly cut off young people, particularly young men who are by nature a bit hopped up from the constraints of trying to interact with people in normal social discourse and normal social interaction, as the lockdown did, they're going to not be exemplifying the best in human nature. They're going to be a little bit wild, a little bit untamed, a little bit uncivilized, and it's possible that some of these recent things have at least some connection to the lockdown.
I'm thinking of another angle on this. 4 years ago, after there were 17 people killed at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida, retired Supreme Court Justice John Paul Stevens said that the solution would be to really attack the problem. And the problem, he said, he didn't talk about culture or any morals or anything like that or the family. He said the problem is the Second Amendment. So he said we need to repeal the Second Amendment because he said it's a relic of the 18th century. And that would solve the problem, said John Paul Stevens, because then we could have all the gun control we wanted without the limitation of the Second Amendment rights. And then, okay, you know, bringing that up to last week, there was this really pretty profound piece written, published in the New Republic, by Timothy Noah, in which he is reflecting on all these things. And he says that a reactionary electoral minority is blocking the way to public safety here. And specifically, get this, this is where I'm going. This is really quite striking. It's a radical analysis, but profoundly wrong, I think. He says that the problem isn't the NRA. It's the same significant largely rural, white, and heavily male minority within the United States. And he says, because of the unrepresentative nature of the Electoral College and the U.S. Senate, this minority's opposition to gun control is sufficient to block any and all legislation intended to address the problem. Because of the unrepresentative nature of the Electoral College and the U.S. Senate, reminder, every state gets two senators. That's by the text of the Constitution. So I even heard this reflected the day after, I think, I was listening to our local news radio station here in San Francisco, and they had a legal expert on who said, you know, the problem is the U.S. Senate, he said, because Wyoming gets two senators and California gets two senators. And so senators from Wyoming and West Virginia, they can block gun control. We've got to reform the Senate, he said. Okay, but think about what that means. I'm almost done, but let me just mention to you what that really means. It's one thing to propose to amend the Constitution by getting rid of the Second Amendment, you know. Good luck with that, but it could be done through the amendment process. But the Constitution's amendment process in Article 5 says explicitly that the equal representation in the Senate is the one and only one thing in the Constitution that cannot be amended using the amendment process. You cannot do it because it says that no state without its a consent shall be deprived of its equal suffrage in the Senate, even if 2/3 of the Congress and 4/5 of the states agree to it. Nevertheless, you can't do it. So what's being proposed here is actually not an amendment to the Constitution.
It's the revolutionary overthrow of the Constitution.
It's the overthrow of the Constitution. Exactly. That's what they're calling for as necessary to solve the problem.
I have some general thoughts on your two underlying points here. So the first one is the idea of repealing the Second Amendment. But there's a deeper or higher level aspect to that, which is the right of self-defense. So what is the right to bear arms? It's the right to use technical means other than, you know, your hands and your feet or something in order to defend yourself. So is Stevens saying that we don't have a right of self-defense in the deep sense and that we have given that over to a third party who is not under our control? That's a very radical position.
And apparently Stevens' view is that we don't have natural rights, we only have legal rights.
All right. He can say that, but I think, honestly speaking, even though the public is not into the arcane aspects of constitutional law, I don't think if you put it to the public and force them to be making decisions and force politicians to be talking publicly about this, they're going to say, oh, you have no right to self-defense. What?
They're not.
All right. So then the other problem has to do, I mean, your point about the Senate and the embedded nature in the Constitution is certainly important. But so I'm a political scientist by training. And one of the aspects of the American political system is it has lots of choke points. It has lots of passages that measures and changes have to go through. And the well-organized, of course, one set of well-organized people are trying to push the measure through, but the defenders are kind of like in Thermopylae, okay? They can stop it. And it's easier to stop things than to have them go through. And so generally, it's thought that the founding fathers, the founders of our country, were in favor of this kind of thing. They didn't want kind of fads to sweep the body politic and get enacted. And so they have these checks and balances and difficult passages to get through. And they thought you're going to have a freer society if things like this are there as safeguards. So the larger question that the New Republic person raises is, are there going to be some kind of scrutiny of pet measures of progressives or pet measures of conservatives for that matter? And if you don't think so, you're going to have, I don't know, I could throw in some example, Jacobin rule France or something like that.
We're going to change the subject, but a last comment from you, Phil, on this question of gun rights.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I think we can tackle the constitutional question here. You know, it's a redefinition of the concept of democracy we're seeing in pieces like the New Republic, and especially coming from the left. And what they mean is everything that they like happens to be democratic, and everything they dislike is undemocratic. But you take something like the Senate or the Electoral College, this has become a talking point in recent years to blame for all the reasons why far left and progressive policies are not making it through. It's not because they're losing at the ballot box. They claim that the system's rigged against them. And they'll point to states like North Dakota and Wyoming and Montana out in the West.
West Virginia.
Yeah, West Virginia. that they say that these are the states that are the problems. They're the ones that are holding up our agenda. What they don't ever mention is that the Northeast, especially New England, is full of very small states, low population states like Vermont, states like Rhode Island, that vote the opposite way.
They're kicking Bernie Sanders out of the national legislature.
That's exactly it. Yeah. And if you rank order the states from the lowest population, the 10 lowest population states split almost evenly between red states and blue states. Basically, this is a call
very,
to get rid of
very
the red
good
states
point.
In the Senate. But they want to keep Rhode Island. They want to keep Vermont. They want to keep Bernie Sanders around to vote, but they want to get rid of anyone that's opposing him.
Yeah, really.
Very
good
well
point.
Stated.
Interestingly, too, because our constitutional system is actually a very complex, balanced mechanism that has many intervening parts, checks and balances of variety of sorts. It's a complicated, beautiful mechanism that has stood the test of time. Let's not trash it.
Okay. Some of us would like to put in more checks and balances.
Yeah. Indeed. Okay, so changing the subject, President Biden has proposed debt relief for college debt. He's now floating the idea of $10,000 off the top debt relief for the certain students who have debt whose income has not yet risen to a certain level. This has been a pretty newsworthy event, so much so that the president of the NAACP, Derek Johnson, says that it doesn't go far enough and it's a slap in the face to just propose $10,000 per person. He said it's like this $10,000 student debt thing is like pouring a bucket of ice water on a forest fire and won't do anything, especially for the Black community, says the president of the NAACP. So, Phil Magnus, you know a lot about economics.
And higher education.
And higher ed.
One of his specialties is higher education.
So is it a good idea, as President Biden proposes, to take off 10% for free of the $10,000 per student of the student debt? Or is it a slap in the face because it's not enough? What do you say,
Phil? Well, I think it's a slap in the face to any concept of sound economic principles. Basically, what we've done here is we've federalized student loans, and this has taken place over many decades of bad policy decisions. And we've done it in such a way that it's basically incentivized what I'd refer to as academic malinvestment. This is people going to college for no particular reason in terms of career aspiration, but pursuing degrees in what I would really call our low yield and junk fields. A lot of the humanities fall into this. Pretty much anything that has the title studies after it. These are majors that have very, very few useful skills in the workforce. And really what ends up happening is people get these degrees and they just stay in the college career track. They move over to the admissions office or they become a dorm manager. So it's really higher ed is soaking up its own overproduction of degrees in some of these areas. And one of the reasons that this has taken off like this is the fact that the federal government has encouraged and incentivized very cheap access to student loans, people to take on debt to get degrees that they really aren't using for functional things in the workforce. I think this is a really perverse incentive as it is, even before you get to the question of, do you start doing debt forgiveness? What are we talking about when we go into even a $10,000 debt forgiveness program? Well, the question there is actually one of distribution. If you look at the people who have taken on the highest amounts of student debt, it's not poor people. It's not first generation college students. These tend to be upper middle class people that have gone on to college to pursue degrees in areas that don't have a career yield to them. So it's basically just a continuation of this.
Or it's lawyers.
It's all right.
Or teachers. Or, you know, so they're kind of subsidizing the new class of Biden voters here. There's multiple things. Your points, by the way, Phil, are fabulously stated in terms of the incentives to the students to go into these less productive degrees. But I think there's a few other things that are sitting on this. So one is the so-called Bennett effect, named after Secretary of Education Bill Bennett, a man I don't cite very often for any number of reasons, but I think he had a good insight here. And he said, look, all this student aid leaves the colleges with a free hand to raise tuition. And so if you, and there's been some empirical support for this work done by regional Federal Reserve banks and things like that. So the idea is if the colleges know that the kids are going to have the money through these loans, they can keep ratcheting up the tuition. And so they do. And so tuition is rising faster than inflation. Though inflation right now is trying to catch up. We'll get to that in a minute.
we're coming there next.
So, yeah, we're getting there. Anyway, then this other question is, what about the people who conscientiously paid this off? And so many people have issued warnings to the Democratic Party, including very prominent Democrats, that if they do this and kick in the teeth the people who conscientiously paid their loans back, there will be a giant reaction. And so not only from those people, but also from working class people who don't have college degrees and say, why is this huge subsidy going to these people? You know, they're going to do better in life anyway. And so, you know, the whole thing of low tuition, zero tuition, subsidized loans is a benefit to people who are going with these degrees to do better in life. And the last question is another kind of moral issue, which is, I could cite Calvin Coolidge in his comment on people who wanted to repudiate the debts from the World War I era. He said, well, they hired the money, didn't they? So in other words, to take that into, by the way, we might talk about it, the people voluntarily took on these loans. And so why should they just be able to get out of it? So there's all those considerations that I think are floating around.
And I wonder,
probably the politically biggest one is the resentment that the people who have paid off the loans are going to have.
So what does a person think who, you know, wasn't hyper academic and looked at the cost of going to college and said, you know, I guess I'm going to forego college because I don't want to build up the debt. I'm just going to do some other job that doesn't require college. So that person, you know, 10 years later sees all the kids who made the unwise decision, they're getting a subsidy and they get off the hook. But he, the guy who didn't, who was being prudent, making financially wise decisions for himself, then he not only doesn't get the fair benefit, but he's going to be paying taxes to pay off the debt of the kids who decided to make a bad financial decision. What's the fairness?
There's the slap in the face. It's actually against the people that acted responsibly, that made prudent financial decisions, that didn't fall into this trap of following government subsidy.
Is there any chance that President Biden, Phil, could be deflected from doing this?
Ooh, I think the only thing that would stand in his way, because, you know, this is something that's really being agitated by the far left of the Democratic Party. And part of the reason there is what Bill mentioned. You subsidize student loans. It basically passes through to tuition. Tuition goes into the administration and they can do what? They hire more underemployed English PhDs and people that are basically political activists. It's a way to expand the college budget's bloat, expand their own bottom line. So that's who's really getting rewarded by this. I think if Biden saw that this measure was genuinely seen as unfair to those who had been fiscally responsible, if it starts to poll bad, if we start seeing some of the pushback that comes from just that basic appeal to fairness, because it is an extremely unfair approach to doing policy, that could be the measure that dissuades him, just as it's dissuaded some of the more moderate Democrats that are kind of saying, right, look at your party, what are you doing here? Let's put the brakes on this a little bit.
And here is a party that's losing its working class constituency.
Absolutely.
And here it is spitting in their eye. So there has been a fair amount of reporting in, you know, the New York Times and other prestige newspapers about the perils of doing this. But the Biden administration doesn't really have many achievements.
No.
That's, you know, they have the American Rescue Plan. And whatever that's, you know, given us additional inflation, and they don't really have anything, and so they want something like this, and they're desperate to get youth enthusiasm, because young people are not finding the Biden administration exciting, interesting, something that's positive from these young people's point of view. And one of the things that helped some Democrats in the past, recently, certainly Obama, but even Biden when he first got elected there, was, you know, young people wanting to vote for him. And he's trying to give them a reason.
Now, you know, we don't usually think of Nancy Pelosi as an old fuddy-duddy, but I would say that on this subject, I'm kind of, well, if not impressed, at least sort of pleased that she did raise the point that the president can't do it, she said at a press conference recently. Not everybody realizes that, but the president can only postpone, delay, and not forgive. So she says the Congress has to pass it. He can't just do it. So good for Nancy Pelosi.
He's certainly acting and talking like he can do it.
Yeah, at least Nancy Pelosi, smaller amount. She says she's going to stand in the way of that. But of course,
well, this partly has to do when they were talking about 50,000.
Right. Yeah, that's
and
true.
That's true. Scale back
to 10.
Yeah. Right. So there they think, well, maybe we can kind of do that and no one will notice.
Well, but hey, the Democrats still have the majority in both houses and they have the presidency until the next election. So maybe Nancy Pelosi will agree to
it. And maybe somebody talked to Joe Manchin and he said 50,000 no, 10,000 yes.
Right. But then will it still be true?
That's totally speculative on my part. But
will it still be true, as Nancy Pelosi says, that the president can only delay, not forgive debt without congressional action? That'll be interesting. Yeah. That'll be interesting. So, okay.
Well, there's, you know, written into these laws, there's often fudge-like language
right.
about discretion of the executive
right.
to do
right.
certain mm-hmm. things administratively. So the Biden administration, the Biden White House, they have some kind of legal counsel that's telling them, well, this is just a minor administrative measure to forgive these
wow.
tens of thousands yeah. of dollars. And that's what they're relying on. Now, I mean, I, of course, would be with Pelosi on this. Don't say that often. But it seems to me.
It feels good, doesn't it, Bill?
Yes. Well, particularly to just had a unfortunate incident in their family. So,
yes.
Mm-hmm. Anyway, I just say it's crazy. We have much too much executive action, too much administrative state action, too much evasion of the need to go to Congress for measures.
Yeah, never underestimate them on what the creative ways that they'll seek to find through
right.
the laws. I mean, consider just a
right.
Just last year, the CDC stepped into the rental market and said that you basically can't
right.
evict
right.
people
right.
during the
this
pandemic.
A disease medical finding, a medical compiling of medical findings association is making economic policy.
Exactly.
I think, by the way, the most fun thing along these lines is the California court that just declared that bees,
right.
bumblebees, are fish.
Flying fish.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. No, not flying
fish. Under the terms of the California Endangered Species Act,
right.
which protects
right.
fish, they
right.
said, well, bees are also endangered. So what, you know, what's the diff, you know? One thing.
Anyway, so as Phil says, never underestimate. In this case, it's a judge, not an administrative
right.
bureaucrat, but... Anyway, yeah, and as we were just saying, the student debt thing is going to be another aspect of inflation. They do all this spending of one sort or another, and then they monetize the debt. So I think Phil would have a lot of thoughts on this inflation situation.
Inflation, Phil. President Biden, he did his op-ed in the Wall Street Journal 2 days ago, and he talked about, you know, the causes exacerbated by the war in Ukraine. Supply chain issues, the pandemic, et cetera, et cetera. What do you think about President Biden's explanation for vast inflation, 40-year high inflation?
Yeah, I think he's grasping at straws to cover up really what comes down to decades of missteps and errors in monetary policy. You know, this goes all the way back to the Federal Reserve. Milton Friedman used to say that inflation is everywhere a monetary phenomenon. It's fundamentally so. And everything we know about the economics of inflation bear that out. But what Biden has done, if you remember just over a year ago when we started getting the first signs of inflation happening, the narrative coming out of the White House was this was only temporary. It was transitory inflation. It was only just a post-COVID adjustment that was going to last maybe a couple months and then we'd be back to normal. Well, it turns out
I felt reassured by that for about 5 minutes.
Exactly. I mean, it sounded great when they pitched it to us. I said, no, but we're fine in the future and we can continue spending like drunken sailors, which is another component of this. I mean, the fact that
it's a vicious attack on drunken sailors.
Well, that
is
exactly. It's the Federal Reserve has basically become the fuel mechanism for federal largesse in spending. And that only was accelerated during COVID. But what we're seeing now is the transitory inflation claims that were dominant in the political talk around this issue a year ago certainly haven't panned out. Quite the opposite has come true. The naysayers against those turned out it was correct. So what is Biden doing? He's searching around for other excuses to blame it on. And that's everything from the war in Ukraine, where he's pointing out that wartime disruptions to the energy industry, for example, could be driving inflation. And then you get some of these really fringe theories that are coming from the far left, where they're trying to blame it on greed, corporate greed. So apparently when gas prices are increasing, that's because of greed. Yet, if you remember 2 years ago at the beginning of COVID, gasoline prices just plummeted, dropped down to, in some cases, like only $1 a gallon.
Obviously, at that time, corporate greed had disappeared.
All the oil companies.
I think we can count on people's greed or people's desires that their preferences be fulfilled to be pretty steady.
Exactly.
And I think we can say, yeah, Ukraine war contributed some a smallish amount. The disruption of the supply chains has contributed something. But the basic thing is government spending. And it's not just in the United States. It's also in other countries, because we have a worldwide phenomenon of government spending. A certain amount of it was COVID-related government spending, or at least the rationale was the COVID.
Yeah. In his Wall Street Journal op-ed, the president commented that deficits are down, and if we keep with his way, we'll keep reducing deficits, and that'll improve the situation. Is that true?
I've heard that one before many times out of both Republican and Democrat administrations, and it never seems to pan out. I think the fiscal incentives and political incentives are always toward more spending and spend your way out of every crisis that comes along. But I think this raises another issue that's important. It is a worldwide phenomenon we're seeing in terms of inflation, but a big part of that is other central banks around the world.
Ours is high.
Yeah, ours is on the high end, but other central banks around the world, they take their cues from what the Federal Reserve is doing.
Exactly.
And in some cases, the Federal Reserve even puts pressure on other countries to follow U.S. policy. They're seen as kind of a leader in that, both in good and bad ways. And yet, what do we have at the Federal Reserve? We have an institution that I would argue has been asleep at the wheel on inflation for the better part of a decade. And on top of all the spending pressures, on top of all the other contributing factors, the Federal Reserve itself has lost sight of its dual mandate. And its dual mandate
is
price stability.
I mean, you're being too kind here. Maybe you're being too kind. What about quantitative easing? What about, all this taking on of greater and greater roles in the economy on the part of the Fed?
And we're seeing
you might
that.
Sometimes wish they were us.
Well, we're seeing that in some of Biden's appointments to the Federal Reserve Board. We're seeing that in some of the pressures. It's no longer a central bank that focuses strictly on monetary policy. They're moving into climate change. They're moving into
social agendas.
The ESG agenda that's also taken part of the corporate world. It's
remind our listeners of what ESG stands.
Oh man, this is I have to go back into the acronym land. But this is basically a corporate social responsibility index they try to. To say for the private sector is that you rate stocks based on whether the company itself is engaged in social justice is essentially what it comes down to.
Exactly.
Environmental, social, and governance are the criteria, ESG, rather than profitability and, careful management. We have one of our friends participating in the program via Vimeo, whose name happens to be Phil, and he sends a question, and could you comment on modern monetary theory? And maybe Dr. Magnus would be happy to comment to the other Phil here on modern monetary theory. What's going on with that?
Yeah, I actually refer to modern monetary theory. I think it's better known as postmodern monetary theory. And that's has a lot of academic similarities to what we see in postmodern philosophy and postmodern literary theory. So PMMT, I guess if we want to use the acronym here, is kind of really this crackpot fringe idea that came out of the heterodox extremes of the economics profession. I'd say over about the last decade or so is when it really started to take hold. And basically what it says is government can exercise its monopolist power over the creation of money, over control of the money supply, to basically manipulate the dollar in such a way that's conducive to expansionary federal spending. And they say the only real concern about this, inflation can be tamped down and controlled by using the tax mechanism, fiscal tools as a lever to constrain the monetary system. And the oddity of it, and this is why I call it postmodern, is they used to be very open about saying that the tax policy component was their safeguard against a run to hyperinflation once you turn on the printing presses to fund everything. Well, now they're all changing their language. They're even examples. Stephanie Kelton was the prominent, one of the prominent spokespersons for this idea. And there was a really popular Twitter thread that she tried to explain MMT about 3 or 4 years ago, and it went viral, and it was supposedly all the talking points. And then now we're in an inflationary period. People have started questioning her in interviews, and she comes up and says, well, I never said we use the tax mechanism to control inflation. And it's like, well, wait a minute, it's right there on your Twitter thread. And by the way, it's also here on page 92 of your book that you wrote. So they're postmodernists.
Phil is famous for pointing to page 92 of so-and-so's book.
Exactly. But they're postmodernists.
It's
in the sense
exactly
that
right to do that.
They move around.
Why we're scholars.
The goalposts move.
They do.
I mean, if words don't have fixed meanings, how can any of these policies be relied upon?
A bee is a fish. That's all I have to say. As Humpty Dumpty once put it, word means what I want it to mean. Nothing more, nothing less.
It makes actually the question of
who is to be master?
Yeah, well, representative self-government, constitutional government, becomes almost impossible when words are subject to infinitely malleable interpretation.
Absolutely.
And it's a little bit worrisome. I was going to ask you guys a question about something else. Bill Evers, you may know something about what's going on with the fires in New Mexico.
Yes.
That's pretty scary. What do you think is behind those? And is it true that the U.S. Forest Service is to blame, as some people have claimed?
Yes, it is true. So the huge fire that's been burning, certainly one of the biggest fires ever in the United States and in New Mexico history as well. It's a confluence of more than one fire, but one of the fires was an out-of-control Forest Service burn. So Forest Service is part of the U.S. Department of Agriculture. And, of course, before there were human beings all over the continent, fires would naturally occur when there were lightning strikes or one thing or another, or sometimes American Indians stuff got out of control, or sometimes American Indians burn things to have grassy areas and things like that. So there have been fires in the past. A lot of the plants and trees and things are adapted to fires, and we should have controlled burns. But if you have a government bureaucracy and government employees and nothing really happens to them, if a fire is not properly managed, then something that they indeed should be doing is not going to get done right. And so, you know, who's going to be fired for this? But this costs a lot of money, and, you know, people die and houses are burned out and so forth. It's a big problem. I mean, it's a problem in California when our electrical lines get blown around. It's the responsibility for fire is a problem. We had a city in Northern California where they decided to dampen traffic so that people would stop in the business area. So they constrained any way, you know, they put high barriers along the one road, it's narrow road. You couldn't drive along the side on the margin. The government did that. So people were trapped and burned alive in this town.
Wow.
So a lot of times government people don't, because they're not liable, because they don't really face consequences, but maybe distant ones in election time, where people are voting on a package of a lot of different things when they vote on a person, they just don't get held responsible. And I think this is, and you know, who votes on the head of the Forest Service or the regional head of the Forest Service? It's not, it's too remote. And, you know,
I noticed that there's a common thread here among a few of these issues having to do with what we sometimes call sovereign immunity. The fact that state agencies, state actors can't be held liable. Phil, as a kind of a long-term view of a historian.
Sometimes they can. There was a case where a government went into a mine that was supposedly a dangerous mine from a possible pollution standpoint. They did something to the mine, and the whole river was destroyed.
That's the Durango, Colorado.
Yes, I remember
that one.
So yeah. I believe they were successfully sued in that case, but it's very rare.
Over the long term, as a historian, what do you see as the problems with sovereign immunity? I mean, a lot of people might say, Phil, that, you know, well, the government shouldn't be sued because then they couldn't do stuff.
Yeah. Well, I think what it does, sovereign immunity basically exacerbates the worst aspects of the central planner, the hubris of the central planner. This is a person that thinks they can get into office or get into a bureaucracy and just issue edicts on high, and those edicts will perfectly fall into place. They'll be abided by. They'll function exactly as we wish that they intended or as the bureaucrat wishes they intended. But it doesn't face the real world constraints, including information constraints, the lack of understanding and knowledge. This is always the pitfall of the central planner. You can have a perfectly mapped out 5-year central plan in your head, but when you put it into action, there's always unforeseen consequences and mistakes and things you didn't account for. And if there's no mechanism to bring that to bear when there's an error in judgment, there's no mechanism to actually control for the mistake, well, that's the situation that we have. It's not the government that we wish we had executing these policies. It's the government that is constrained by corruption, incompetence, all of the same problems we saw in the Uvalde police force play out in places like forest fires. They also play out in environmental policy. They play out in public health policy. Just look at Anthony Fauci over the past 2 years, if you want to see an example of hubris run amok that doesn't have any consequences behind it. You know, these are people that are used to ruling by edict for a world that they imagine they can control, but the real world is very different from that.
Interestingly, of course, even well-intended government action can cause harm to individuals, much less ill-intended ones. But even well-intended ones can cause harm. And if the only recourse of a harmed individual is to wait for the next election, I'm not sure that's enough, is it, Phil?
Not at all. And, you know, the track record of government throughout history is of unintended consequences and failures. You know, the famous one from the Prohibition era. When they banned alcohol, they thought, oh, this is a very moralizing thing to do. It's going to purge the sin of alcoholism from society. There will be public health benefits. It'll help families that are torn apart by an alcoholic. It will help them reunite. That was all the public pledge. Well, it turns out what they do is they incentivize the creation of a very violent black market. And then the next step, they thought, well, people were turning away from alcohol for consumption to medicinal alcohol. So they started adopting policies. The U.S. government started basically introducing poison into rubbing alcohol, medicinal alcohol, to stop people from drinking it. Well, the word didn't get out, and then it ends up they killed basically thousands of people in the 1920s as a result of a pure error in the way that they executed on this policy. And, you know, that's just one example of unintended consequences and bad policies going awry. But again, it comes back to the planner's mentality. They think they know everything, but there's always something that's out of reach, always something that imperfect information makes inaccessible to the planner because there are no feedback loops. There are no mechanisms. Yeah.
And they're legally immune.
And they're legally immune. There's no consequence if you err.
Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Wow. So just, I saw something in the New York Times just the other day that is a spillover effect of Fauci and lockdowns and all this sort of thing. And that had to do with proctoring of remote examinations.
which are much more common nowadays.
Yes. Yes. So let's say you're in the K-12 system or you're in higher education, you're in a college or university, and you've been learning online, or maybe you're learning in a hybrid situation somehow nowadays. Or you're in some kind of just video class, which we're getting more of in universities. And so it's time for an exam or for a midterm. So they have ways of trying to monitor whether you're cheating. And the problem is, as this article makes clear, because it was an accusation and the person that was accused comes in and proves that what was alleged isn't right. And of course, the bureaucracy isn't inhibited by this. It's a juggernaut and it goes ahead and penalizes the individual. But the thing is, the underlying big problem is that it can be an invasion of privacy. I mean, it could be a camera that sweeps your whole house. There can be things that intrude into other aspects of what's in your computer. Now, there are various more narrow proctoring software, and you can have, we have in California a proposed law that would help protect student privacy, but you know, it's maybe slightly more expensive to do it right, and you know, it's a hassle to do it right. And so here we have something that, you know, in a way could be celebrated, which is being able to give remote exams and to proctor them to see that cheating isn't going on. And yet, with the other hand, there are these unintended consequences, and because the bureaucrats involved don't suffer anything from it, hey, it's cool with them to invade the student's privacy. Yeah. So hopefully this is
not, I think not you a, told me that the Times article said that there was actually an algorithm used in the system for supposedly detecting cheating.
I have that too.
I mean, if it's
again,
an algorithm.
This is like our Minority Report problem, that the algorithm is going to have some false positives, right? And so anyway, the point is, it's an interesting subject. It's part of our technological advance, and yet we want to protect the rights of individuals from abusive oversight.
One of the things we apparently always have to be on the lookout for is to watch for unintended consequences, especially of public power.
Sometimes they are intended.
The intention.
Either way, we need to be on the lookout because things don't always turn out the way they're advertised at the beginning.
Right.
We're going to draw this to a conclusion in a minute here, but last thought to Phil Magnus. Everyone's reeling as they go to the gas pump.
Yeah.
And so here in California, I think I paid $6.59 a gallon recently. It's just stunning. How high do you think these gas prices are going to have to go before the public reacts and there has to be a serious policy change, Phil?
Well,
is there any place that's going to happen?
I think we're already starting to see some of that reaction. And, you know, a few states that are less captive to the environmental lobby have proposed things like lifting, even if temporarily, some of the gasoline taxes as a means of alleviating it. I think we're also starting to see some pressures that are coming to bear on environmental regulations that have stopped oil production in certain states. Now, unfortunately, a lot of that is out of the federal government's federal policy, and the Biden administration has adopted a stance that they want to keep fossil fuels in the ground for climate change reasons and all these environmental pursuits that they have. So in a sense, there's a perverse incentive for them. The fact that gasoline prices are rising, a lot of people in the administration think that that's a good thing.
Wow.
So that's a real problem.
That is going on.
It's a way to force people to use less gas.
But they don't want to be unpopular for them rising. So they're kind of caught in a
trap.
Trap.
They back themselves into a corner, and you know, they're stuck between the environmental lobby on one side and the fact that high gasoline prices are deeply unpopular, because that's one of the areas. It's like that and groceries are the two areas where inflation hits you the most in the pocketbooks. So,
and of course, we can't drop this topic without saying price controls often look attractive to a politician as doing something.
Yeah.
And of course, they have tremendous perverse effects, because prices give us information. They allocate things to their highest valued use. If you start dictating prices or monkeying with prices, you destroy the flow of information and sound rational decision making in the society. The government is not going to be able to do this. You will have all the problems of black markets and crime.
Oh man, I'll say. Yeah.
I could go on and on. And there's a famous book that Robert Schrödinger wrote about, I don't know, 10,000 years of inflation, of price controls or something like that.
So what's interesting is that the environmentally driven restrictions are restricting the supply of gasoline and petroleum. And then, of course, federal spending, which has skyrocketed.
Pipeline
restrictions.
Cutting off the pipeline. Yeah, and then the inflation resulting from federal spending are both pushing prices dramatically
up.
Both those things are harming Americans in the pocketbook, but especially the least privileged, the people with the lowest incomes, who allegedly are supposed to be the beneficiaries of the federal spending.
Yeah.
Right. Well, the traditional point that people on fixed incomes, in quick summation, widows and orphans, are the victims of this sort of thing, because they're not going to get an adjustment, quick adjustment to what their income is. That's right. The most vulnerable are badly affected.
We are grateful for your insights as a historian, as an economist, Phil Magnus. Any parting words of wisdom from us?
I just echo what Bill said. You know, environmentalism is a luxury of the well-off. The average working class person doesn't have $70,000 to go spend on an electric car. They don't have money that they can use on luxury environmental goods. And I think we're really seeing that come to bear here, that a lot of the people that have these policy preferences and these political beliefs are those that have income levels that give them the luxury to entertain those beliefs and give them the luxury to make decisions on how they spend their money that the least well-off do not have. So in an interesting way, the progressive left, which claims to be acting on behalf of the poor, is really pursuing policies that are directly harmful to the poor, directly harmful to the least well-off. And I see this really as a continuation of what they did during COVID. The lockdowns hurt the poor the most. Inflation hurts the poor the most. This is something that we see time and again across history, and yet it's people that project themselves as enlightened progressives that care about the poor that are really driving the policies that end up to be economically the most harmful.
And while they're hurting the poor, they're feeling good about themselves,
exactly.
Which makes it, to me, morally even worse.
Yeah.
Bill Evers, any parting words of wisdom from you?
Only that I've really enjoyed having Phil Magnus on
it's
this.
Great.
And I hope he can do it sometimes in the future, because you added an excellent dimension to it.
We will try and induce you to come back, Dr. Phil
Absolutely.
Magnus. Thank you. Dr. Bill Evers, thank you. And thank you to all of our friends who've joined us across our many platforms. Come back again and join us for Independent Outlook. Thanks again. Bye, everybody.